in cyberspace. Our traditional and digital operations grew more symbiotic as we tracked, harassed, captured, and killed terrorists all over the world. We would enhance our counterterrorism operations with other technical collection platforms, such as the UAV Predator drone, as we placed a growing emphasis on fusing more and more streams of intelligence to find specific targets in both the cyber and real worlds. Chapter 5. Liaising. Close alliances with despots are never safe for free states. Demosthenes, Second Philippic Oration. Foreign liaison is an important part of the CIA's intelligence business. Liaison relationships are constructed as cooperative exchanges and joint operational ventures. Foreign partners can advance the CIA's collection, analysis, and covert action missions. Such partnerships can be anything from a simple swap of intelligence to multi-year, multi-million-dollar technical collection in which the CIA provides the funding and equipment while the foreign liaison provides the cover, access, and operational reach. In some cases, vital counterintelligence about common adversaries is shared. So are technologies and tradecraft tactics. These operations can also consist of an integration of officers and experts from foreign services. As an example, for years, a Middle Eastern intelligence service has provided case officers and agents to assist the CIA in counterterrorism operations. There is even deeper cooperation with other allies on a wide variety of training programs and operations, which include massive joint signals intelligence missions. In 1981, the FARM's instructors taught us very little about foreign liaison. We concentrated on unilateral operations. This was not a bad approach, in retrospect, because without unilateral sources, a spy agency becomes just another international information exchange. A real spy agency's mission, first and foremost, is espionage. That means recruiting and running spies. The FARM's instructors pounded that into us. When asked about liaison, they responded that in time, whenever that might be, we would receive on-the-job training. They also noted that liaison existed for one primary purpose, to gain access to these foreign services and recruit sources within their ranks. This was the best means of counterintelligence. There is no better way to catch a hostile service's spy than having a penetration of that service. A large percentage of the foreign spies revealed in the U.S. government are uncovered as a result of CIA sources in the ranks of their respective foreign services. The liaison for spying doctrine also affords the CIA opportunities to piggyback on the collection of another service. If country X has clandestine networks in the Far East, and the CIA has a source who runs country X's Far East networks, the reporting secretly flows to the CIA. The same is true for a penetration of a foreign service's SIGINT service. Such a source could route SIGINT collection to the CIA. These penetrations also afford the CIA access to other potential HUMINT sources and also to technical collection within the host target service. In this manner, the CIA unilaterally leverages foreign intelligence sources for huge streams of data otherwise unavailable through normal liaison channels. Of course, there are exceptions to this bias toward unilateralism. The CIA does not attempt to penetrate the services of a few key allies. The overarching value of these bilateral intelligence relationships far outweighs the potential downside of an espionage flap. The even more valuable political alliance also proscribes such a risk. I would learn this firsthand in the years to come, especially in the counterterrorism arena. The overwhelming bias in our instruction at the FARM was the recruitment of unilateral sources. For a junior officer assigned behind the Iron Curtain, that meant servicing dead drops and other means of impersonal communications with little chance to run recruitment operations. If a junior operations officer was assigned to Western Europe, especially to a major U.S. ally, the chances of liaison duties trumping unilateral operations were far higher than for a similarly ranked officer in an African backwater. This was a key reason, in my mind, to avoid an assignment to Europe or any division with large stations and heavy liaison chores. I aimed to serve as a unilateral undercover operations officer for as long as possible. Unilateral junior officers, as opposed to those assigned to liaison duty, generally have decent cover because they work cover jobs during the day and avoid contacts with foreign liaison services. Obviously, as junior officers, they have limited experiences and less exposure, which means better cover. For an aggressive recruiter, however, a degradation of cover is not unusual. An officer can only avoid all risks to his cover by doing nothing. On the other hand, the longer an officer preserves cover, the more opportunities exist to chase and run unilateral sources. Striking the balance between protecting cover and running aggressive operations was imperfect work and an everyday concern. During the early part of my career as an operations officer, I recruited and ran dozens of unilateral sources and subsources throughout three continents. I wrote hundreds of intelligence reports derived from hundreds of meetings with sources. We held brief encounters and meetings in rolling cars, luxury hotel rooms, safe houses, thatched huts, boats, bookstores, alleyways, public bathrooms, and under shade trees. For more than a decade of field service, I avoided liaison responsibilities with any foreign governments. When my introduction to foreign liaison finally came, it was with a twist. I did not meet a foreign government representative, but rather the leader of a rebel army. Guerrilla Liaison. The dim, musty hotel hallway seemed to stretch a long way. Both of my escorts, one in front and one in back, walked purposefully, silently. They were trim, muscular men who clearly had spent years fighting in the bush. I respected their preference for silence. I mimicked the pace and movement and kept my mouth shut. A single guard stood at the door to the suite. I entered. My escorts and the guard stayed in the hallway. It was even dimmer in the room, and I squinted, then blinked a couple of times to focus on the two trim, statuesque women flanking the interior door to the next room. They were strikingly beautiful, in a hard and sharp way, and also relaxed, almost languorous. They could have been cast in a James Bond film. They wore no expression, just seemed to pose as if part of the decor. Without gawking, which was not easy, I walked through the interior door. They followed, with a smooth and silky motion, and flanked the man. One laid her hand on the back of his chair. He was sitting in a big, overstuffed chair in the middle of the room. He was rubbing the top of his head. He stopped to shake hands with me. He motioned me to sit. He then continued rubbing his head in a slow, semicircular motion. He looked tired, maybe from all the years leading a bush rebellion. Or maybe he had malaria. Or maybe the two Bond babes had worn him out. Maybe all of the above. My COS had told me this guy was one of the smartest he had ever met, and my COS had met plenty of smart guys. So no matter how tired this guerrilla leader appeared, I knew not to underestimate him. Just the opposite, in fact, given that he had survived hard combat for years and was now gaining ground. The CIA was predicting that he was a winner, and we needed to know more. We needed to build a deeper relationship with his organization. "Thanks for meeting with me," I offered. "What is your name?" he asked. "Frank," I lied. "Okay, sure," he responded, realizing it was a lie and that it didn't matter. "My boss sends his regards," I added. "A good man, your boss. He says you are good also. I hope he is correct. We have much to discuss. With no further preliminary comment, we explored how the U.S. government perceived his organization, his objectives, and his future. He offered his thoughts. I provided mine. The U.S. government was critically important to the future of his country, he explained. He outlined his plans for the coming weeks and years. He was ambitious, clearly, but in a calculating and patient way. He spoke about the insurgency, but also about the regional powers and their views of his efforts. We discussed the Libyans, Soviets, and Chinese. He articulated his plans after victory, for his country's infrastructure, education, healthcare, commerce, and women's rights. We touched on political theory. I did not take notes, but struggled to keep up with all his information, which I would turn into intelligence reports once I got back to the station. I wondered if I could keep up with him intellectually.